Not only was the husband of defendant Lainey Greenberger connected with the Medellin cartel, a major player in the Iran-Contra scandal, but also apparently some of the people being charged with the murder of Roy Radin, former members of Larry Flint's security detail, have apparently, or there have been allegations that they shook down the attorney in the United States for General Noriega. Also, the allegations have surfaced that there was a plot to murder Mitchell Werbel, a longtime soldier of fortune, affiliate of the U.S. intelligence community, and another individual whose name crops up in connection with elements of the Contra supply effort in its early years. At any rate, obviously, the connections there are, as are so many other things, food for thought and grounds for further research. But these investigations are beginning to dovetail. That is to say, the Satanism/process connection and the some of the drug connections of the Iran-Contra scandal, we're beginning to see these dovetailing. And again, the entire working hypothesis of the Ultimate Evil series is that some satanic cults are basically being used as intelligence fronts. Food for thought, grounds for further research, more information on this very exciting story developing in the Napa Sentinel. But let's see whether this develops in the mainstream news media. So far, it's been pretty quiet. So you thought you were free, huh? Well, stick around. We'll find out. A little music and then more information. Good evening. Welcome back once again to the prepared portion of One Step Beyond. It'll be interesting to see if... the situation in Napa gets the kind of press coverage that it deserves. The person who's been supplying me with these articles called up to say that in the latest issue it said, and again this will be verified and included into the archives as we cover the Lendvest drug tug situation, according to the listener who's supplying me with these articles from Napa, the latest article mentions that Kenneth Armitage had agreed to roll over. In other words, he agreed to reveal who owned this particular island and all the information about it in exchange for immunity from prosecution. Well, we know what happened to him, so stick around. You thought you were free? Wait and see. Very important article was contained in the July 1989 issue of Harper's Magazine. And we're going to read some parts of this, and this again relates to media coverage or the lack thereof and how it relates to democracy or the lack thereof. This article was written by Walter Karp, last name K-A-R-P, and again, this is called All the Congressman's Men, or I should say for the first time, this is called All the Congressman's Men by Walter Karp, subheaded How Capitol Hill Controls the Press. And again, this is from the July 1989 issue of Harper's Magazine. We're going to read some sections of it and ruminate for a while on freedom of the press or lack thereof. Mr. Karp's article reads in part, On November 9, 1984, Arthur Oakes Sulzberger, publisher of the New York Times, inadvertently shed fresh light on one of the all-too-settled questions of American life. Who decides what is news in America? That is, who tells us what we know about our country's ongoing political life? The enlightening occasion was a speech that Sulzberger delivered at Yale University warning of new dangers to liberty in America. Silently and relentlessly, the Reagan administration was expanding official secrecy, intimidating the press, and constricting public access to public information. The disdain toward the press displayed in the Grenada action was part of a frightening information policy by the administration, said Sulzberger. What made that policy even more insidious, he added, was that it had gone, quote, largely overlooked by the general public, unquote, including the readers of the New York Times, which had covered the near-weekly installments of the frightening policy, unquote, without giving any inkling that the installments added up to a policy and that it was frightening indeed. Skipping down in the article, What consensual value could be more authoritative in America than democracy, which Sulzberger, armed cap a pie with might and right, stood up to defend from danger on November 9, 1984? That's the speech I just read you a section of. What happened? Nothing at all. The frightening information policy remained almost as overlooked by the general public 4 years after Sulzberger's speech as it had been the day he delivered it, although the policy remained unaltered and grew even bolder for a time. Just 3 days before Sulzberger spoke, the administration had proposed new regulations that made it a felony under the export control laws for a Defense Department official to export, quote-unquote, to his fellow Americans any non-classified technical information, for example, by talking to a newspaper reporter. Heavy fines and long prison terms would await the public servant who gave his countrymen documentary evidence of waste and fraud in the administration's waste and fraud-ridden military buildup. One more time. Just 3 days before Sulzberger spoke, the administration had proposed new regulations that made it a felony under the export control laws for a Defense Department official to export, quote-unquote, to his fellow Americans any non-classified technical information, for example, by talking to a newspaper reporter. Heavy fines and long prison terms would await the public servant who gave his countrymen documentary evidence of waste and fraud in the administration's waste and fraud-ridden military buildup. Remarkable. Remarkable situation. That, again, was not regarded as being particularly crucial by the New York Times. Karp goes on to say, to this latest installment of the frightening information policy, Sulzberger's editors replied on November 10th, quote, again, this from the New York Times, casting a penumbra over all non-secret scientific and technical information will deny the Pentagon the benefit of valuable public criticism, quote unquote. Karp goes on to comment, what frightening policy? What policy at all? The Reagan administration was not trying to stifle public criticism. It was guilty at most of underestimating its benefits. So said the editors of the New York Times, tacitly rebuking Citizen Sulzberger. The mighty publisher of the mighty Times had dared champion liberty, and his own editors sided with its powerful foes by casting a penumbra of servile blather over their plans and ambitions. So let us start afresh and ask again, who decides what is news in America? Karp goes on to point out that so many of the news stories we read come from, quote, official sources, unquote. In other words, basically the government. And that any time a reporter goes out and actually digs on his own, that's called investigative journalism. In a nutshell, it's the thesis of Karp's article. That basically is why we get such drivel. And that in addition to that, there is active not only censorship by the government, but also actual pressure on various media voices when they don't willingly censor themselves. Another part of Karp's article reads, for nearly 6 years, New York Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan charged in numerous speeches and op-ed articles that our present paralyzing budget deficits were deliberately created by President Reagan and his faction. By slashing taxes, not to mention doubling military spending, they planned from the start to, quote, create a fiscal crisis, unquote, Moynihan said, and use that crisis to force the country against its will to reduce social spending for years to come. One more time. For nearly 6 years, New York Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan charged in numerous speeches and op-ed articles that our present paralyzing budget deficits were deliberately created by President Reagan and his faction. By slashing taxes, not to mention doubling military spending, they planned from the start to create a fiscal crisis, unquote, Moynihan said, and use that crisis to force the country against its will to reduce social spending for years to come. The indictment was truly grave. An American president conspiring to deceive the American people in order to achieve goals he would never have dared avow? The would-be source was impeccable, a prominent senator, respected, reflective, and uncommonly eloquent. Yet Moynihan's indictment never became news, not even in the spring of 1986, when David Stockman's astonishing memoirs substantiated that indictment in dense and vivid detail. Instead of turning the former budget director's memoirs into momentous news, Washington's press corps attacked Stockman for writing them. Quote, in all this torrent of comment about the book, unquote, noted James Reston of the Times, quote, there is very little analysis of his indictment of the methods and men who are still deciding the nation's policies, unquote. The press fled from the story, Moynihan said, because, quote, the political class cannot handle this subject, unquote. Against a political establishment resolved to keep dreaded knowledge from the country, not even an eminent senator can make that knowledge news on his own. One of the important parts of Karp's article is that he points out in the article that basically active pressure is brought on those media voices that don't willingly censor their news. Active pressure is brought on them by the authorities. And he goes on to describe, basically, at least in part here, I'm not going to read the whole article, but in part I'm going to read you how the pressure is brought to bear. Again, from Karp's articles here. From Karp's article. The Wicker referred to here is New York Times columnist and editor Tom Wicker, W-I-C-K-E-R. Quote, aggressive challenges to the official version of things, unquote, arouse what Wicker calls, again quoting, establishment disapproval and brings down the establishment lash. Lost access, complaints to editors and publishers, social penalties, leaks to competitors, a variety of responses no one wants. Quote, unquote, again quoting, this of a different source, to examine critically the institutions and mores of government, notes Leonard Downey Jr., managing editor of the Washington Post, quote, might mean breaking friendships with trusted government contacts, missing the consensus front-page stories everyone else is after, or failing to be followed down a new path of inquiry, unquote. Punishments need not be draconian. Quote, manipulating access, says Wicker, is the most standard means of stroking and threatening, and by all odds the most effective, even against bold and independent reporters, unquote. If draconian methods are needed, political leaders do not scruple to use them. And we're going to talk a little bit here about what Walter Karp means by draconian efforts. He basically is referring to outright pressure by political forces on journalistic ones. In this case, he's talking about pressure by the Nixon White House on the New York Times and CBS News, and specifically CBS here, to willingly censor their information. And when they didn't do that, then downright threats were delivered, in this case by Charles Colson, a Nixon White House aide. And again, this is pressure on CBS by the Nixon White House with regard to their Watergate coverage. That was not compliant enough for the White House, however. A few days after Nixon's re-election, Colson called up Paley's longtime lieutenant, Frank Stanton, to issue a still more sweeping threat. If CBS persisted in broadcasting hostile news about the president, the White House would ruin CBS on Wall Street and Madison Avenue. "We'll break your network," said Tierney's little henchman. Stanton suppressed his rage. Paley, deeply ashamed, told no one of Colson's threats. Why didn't these two media magnates turn those threats into news? What else is a free press for if not to help a free people hold the powerful to account? Yet here was a president grossly abusing the power of his office, which was newsworthy in itself, in order to censor the news, which was doubly newsworthy, so that the electorate might not hold him accountable at the polls, which was newsworthy three times over. Well, that's what the Walter Karp article refers to as draconian measures in order to silence critical media voices. We're going to take another short musical break and come back and take a look at what may be even more draconian measures. Back in a little bit. Good evening. Welcome once again to the prepared portion of One Step Beyond. So you thought you were free. Well, a lot of people thought they were free, and that they turned out to be wrong. Now, that last article by Walter Karp, the late Walter Karp, dealt with why, basically, important stories do not get covered by our major media voices, or at least covered as they should be. And he was talking about direct pressure by political forces on journalistic ones in order to tone down their coverage. And that even includes threats against the institutions. In the 1980s, with such pressure groups as Accuracy in Media, founded by right-wing activist Reed Urban, the political right has openly assailed those media voices that they don't feel toe the proper political line. And of course, as we looked at in a show about Reed Urban's attempts to knock One Step Beyond out of the box, there are massive and ongoing connections between the intelligence community and Reed Urban, and specifically between John Singlaub and the World Anti-Communist League and Reed Urban. Again, the book Inside the League by John Lee and Scott Anderson talks about that. Those authors' work is excerpted, and that book is excerpted in the aforementioned miscellaneous archive show called The Accuracy in Media and One Step Beyond. What I wonder, perhaps, is whether the pressure on various media voices goes beyond just threatening the institutions themselves. There have been a lot of strange deaths of various of key media people over the years. We're going to talk about a few of them, one which catches my eye, and we don't know if this was the result of foul play, but I certainly think questions need to be asked. The very same New York Times, spoken of in Walter Karp's article, the New York Times, in this case of Thursday, August 10th of 1989, contained the following obituary by Eric Pace of the New York Times, spelled P-A-C-E. This is the obituary of James M. Markham, M-A-R-K-H-A-M, dead at 46, chief of the Times Paris Bureau. James M. Markham, the New York Times bureau chief in Paris, died there yesterday, apparently of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. He was 46 years old. Mr. Markham was one of the Times' senior correspondents. Over the last two decades, he served in Africa, Asia, the Middle East, and Western Europe before being named deputy foreign editor last month. He was due to leave France next month to take up his new post in New York. Police investigators said Mr. Markham was found dead at his home yesterday morning with a head wound. He was lying on his bed. He was lying on his bed in a dressing gown, a hunting gun next to his body. No note was found. Mr. Markham spent most of his career as a foreign correspondent and had been with the Times since 1971. Before becoming the Times bureau chief in Paris in 1987, he had been bureau chief in two other European posts: Madrid from 1976 to 82, and Bonn from 1982 to 1987. While stationed in Madrid, he roved widely, covering revolutionary Iran and the Israeli invasion of southern Lebanon in 1978. He was bureau chief in Beirut in 1975 and 76, covering the fighting in the civil war involving Muslim, Christian, Syrian, and Palestinian factions. Earlier, from 1973 to 1975, he was the bureau chief in Saigon, traveling from there to report also from Laos, Thailand, and Cambodia. There are a lot of different things, obviously, that Markham covered that would have involved national security and or intelligence issues. Any of his Middle East or Southeast Asian work could have brought him in contact with very sensitive information. I wonder perhaps if he knew anything at all about something relating to the Iran-Contra scandal, or whether perhaps his reputation as a journalist basically made him a no-no to the powers that be. One of the single most important lesson of studying America's political assassinations is that basically, aside from the important historical forces that were changed by the assassinations, the most important lesson of all is that by the early 1960s, our national security establishment had actively undertaken to eliminate those American citizens, and politicians in particular, who they considered troublesome and averse to their interests. Obviously, the Kennedys, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and others are long dead. One wonders perhaps if the spate of deaths of various media people critical of the Reagan administration is something more than just coincidence. I wonder perhaps if that is accuracy in media taken somewhat further. Again, we know, as a matter of public record, that by 1963, the U.S. National Security Establishment had actively undertaken to eliminate, by violent force if necessary, those people, those American citizens, political figures in particular, whom they found troublesome. I wonder, perhaps, if the death of James Markham was really all that it appears to be, namely a suicide. One of the many ways in which the U.S. National Security Establishment eliminates people in such a way as to make it appear to be an accident or a suicide is through an assassination technique in which the victim is shot usually in the back of the head with a small caliber weapon, then a shotgun is placed in the victim's mouth. That is set off, and of course that blows the individual's head practically clean off, obscuring the smaller gunshot wound which originally felled the victim in question. I wonder perhaps if the hunting gun found next to his body is such a weapon, or whether it's a high-caliber rifle which would have sort of a similar effect. It would produce a much more massive wound which could serve to obscure a smaller one. That is an assassination technique as described by Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, former Air Force focal point officer, and an individual who's done a great deal of writing on the U.S. National Security Establishment and the intelligence agencies. The book The Secret Team is notable by Fletcher Prouty. Again, the motion picture called 3 Days of the Condor, for those people who are skeptical that a suicide couldn't be faked, at the very end of that movie, a renegade CIA official is dispatched. Basically, a gun is held to his head, and he is then disarmed. The trigger is then pulled. The fingerprints are wiped off the gun, and it's placed in the victim's hand. This appears to be a suicide to the to the average observer. One of the things that I took note of when I observed the death of James Markham, it brought to mind a couple of alleged suicides of mainstream journalists, which took place within 3 weeks of each other in calendar year 1985. These two deaths were covered in a two-part archive series called Your Hit Parade, Parts 1 and 2, that deals with suspicious deaths and disappearances of political activists and journalists in the United States. In particular, we took a look at the deaths, both of apparently self-inflicted gunshot wounds, of a New York Times writer named Faye Joyce, who had just received a promotion and was moving down to the Atlanta Constitution, and she had covered the campaign of Walter Mondale for the Democrats in 1984. A few weeks later, a woman named Nancy Skelton, named last name S-K-E-L-T-O-N, who had written about, among others, the Jesse Jackson campaign for the Los Angeles Times, died also of an apparently self-inflicted gunshot wound, just like James M. Markham. And again, obviously, we can't draw conclusions from this, but again, I think these are questions we had better ask. When we see politicians or when we see journalists dying under ambiguous circumstances, we want to ask the question about just what those circumstances were. Again, food for thought and grounds for further research. A chilling postscript to the Walter Karp article I read you. Again, that was in the July 1989 issue of Harper's, that particular Walter Karp article. A chilling postscript to that appeared in the New York Times, the very same New York Times which employed the late James Markham described above. The New York Times, on the 20th day of July of 1989, in its obituary section, had the obituary of the writer who wrote that article that we just excerpted a few minutes ago, Walter Karp. This also is an obituary by Eric Pace of the New York Times. It's the obituary of Walter Karp, last name K-A-R-P, writer specializing in political history, is dead at 55. Again, New York Times, 7-20-89, his Harper's article, July of 1989. The article reads, in part, Walter Karp, a writer specializing in United States political history, died yesterday morning in the Roosevelt Hospital Division of St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital Center, said Kathy Rohan, a hospital spokeswoman. He was 55 years old and lived on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Ms. Rohan did not give the cause of death. Mr. Karp's wife, the former Regina Pollock, said the cause of death was not known, but that an autopsy was being done. I'm going to read those last two sentences again. Ms. Rohan did not give the cause of death. Mr. Karp's wife, the former Regina Pollock, said the cause of death was not known, but that an autopsy was being done. Mrs. Karp said her husband was admitted to the hospital on July 13th, suffering from an enlarged colon. He had surgery for it on Sunday night, suffered from complications after the surgery, and then was in intensive care, she said. Mr. Karp, the author of 8 books, was a longtime contributing editor of Harper's Magazine, whose publisher John R. MacArthur said yesterday, quote, Walter Karp is one of the very few writers, journalists, and citizens that I have ever met who actually lived, but maybe even more importantly, articulated the Jeffersonian ideal. He was a ceaseless foe of government intrusion on civil liberties and also deeply suspicious of political power, unquote. The July issue of Harper's includes an article by Mr. Karp called All the Congressman's Men, How Capitol Hill Controls the Press. Walter Karp, dead at 55. Rest in peace, Walter Karp. Well, again, I have the same question about the death of Walter Karp for saying the same reason. Basically, is it live or is it Memorex? Was it really just complications? Was perhaps the enlarged colon for a case of cancer? One of the things that we have looked at considerable length on this broadcast over the years is the fact that our national security establishment, as a matter of public record, has had means of giving people cancer since 1954. We took a look at that, by the way, also in not only the aforementioned miscellaneous archive show about Reed Urban, but also in the archive show concerning the late Mae Brussell. That archive show is called A Tribute to the Late Mae Brussell and a Discussion of the Circumstances Surrounding Her Death. We've talked about the capabilities on the part of our national security establishment of giving people cancer. Freedom of Information Act documents prove that they were able to do that as early as 1954. Again, when we see someone dying of allegedly natural causes, one of the questions we have to ask is, are they really natural causes? Because one of the major focuses of research, one of the major foci of research by the U.S. National Security Establishment has been means of killing people in such a way as to make it appear to be natural or accidental death. We're going to take a look and now read into the archives a couple of declassified documents. These are contained in a book entitled, appropriately enough, Documents by Christy Macy, M-A-C-Y, and Susan Kaplan, K-A-P-L-A-N. Those are the editors. This is copyrighted 1980, softcover edition by Penguin Books. Again, Documents, Christy Macy and Susan Kaplan. And in this particular book of documents, we find a couple of declassified documents. This is a declassified CIA memorandum. It's from November 29th of 1949. It reads in part, and note that two paragraphs of this document were never declassified. It reads in part, I regret taking so long to supply you with my thoughts on the problem which you raised when I saw you last. Rather than attempt to organize a logical outline of all the means by which the type of activity you mentioned might be accomplished, I am simply setting down the means that I think might be most efficacious. You will recall that I mentioned that the local circumstances under which a given means might be used might suggest the technique to be used in that case. I think that gross divisions in presenting the subject might be one, bodies left with no hope of the cause of death being determined by the most complete autopsy and chemical examination, two, bodies left in such circumstances as to simulate accidental death, three, bodies left in such circumstances as to simulate suicidal death, and four, bodies left with residue that simulate those caused by natural diseases. I'm going to repeat that last paragraph again. You will recall that I mentioned that the local circumstances under which a given means might be used might suggest the technique to be used in that case. I think that gross divisions in presenting this subject might be one, bodies left with no hope of the cause of death being determined by the most complete autopsy and chemical examination, two, bodies left in such circumstances as to simulate accidental death, three, bodies left in such circumstances as to simulate suicidal death, and four, bodies left with residue that simulate those caused by natural diseases. I believe that there are two chemical substances which would be most useful in that they would leave no characteristic pathologic findings, and the quantities needed could be easily transported to the places where they were to be used. One of these, sodium fluoacetate, when ingested in sufficient quantities to cause death, does not cause characteristic pathologic lesions, nor does it increase the amount of fluorine in the body to such a degree that it can be detected by quantitative methods. The other chemical substance which I have in mind is tetraethyl lead, which, as you know, could be dropped on the skin in very small quantities, producing no local lesion, and after a quick death, no specific pathological evidences of the tetraethyl lead would be present. If an individual could be put into a relatively tightly sealed room with a block of CO2 ice, it is highly probable that his death would result and that there would be no chances of the circumstances being detected. It is highly probable, though, that there would be a period of hyperactivity in the course of such a death. Another possibility would be the exposure of the entire individual to X-ray. When the whole body is exposed, a relatively small amount of radiation is sufficient to produce effects that would lead to death within a few weeks. And it is highly probable that sporadic deaths of this kind would be considered due to blood dyscrasias, as little as 800 Rentgens would do it. If it were possible to subject the individual to a cold environment, he would freeze to death when his body temperature reached around 70 degrees, and there is no anatomic lesion that is diagnostic in such cases. There are two other techniques which I believe should be mentioned, since they require no special equipment besides a strong arm and the will to do such a job. These would be either to smother the victim with a pillow or to strangle him with a wide piece of cloth, such as a bath towel. In such cases, there is no specific anatomic change to indicate the cause of death, though there may be serotial petechiae and marked visceral congestion, which would suggest strangulation along with some other possibilities. I hope you will forgive the random way in which I may have set these things down, and I am sure there are many exotic alkaloids and other chemical substances which might be used, but of which I am sure you have as much information available or intrinsic knowledge as I have. If I can be of any further aid to you, I hope you will call on me. Sincerely yours, and obviously the signature is not listed there, that is, well, interesting to say the least. Now, it's significant, of course, to examine this document in its historical perspective. Obviously, some of the means suggested of disposing people here are not the most practical, locking them in a room with a block of CO2 or X-raying them. But some of these are obviously very, very, very simple indeed. And it's worth noting again that two paragraphs of this document were not declassified. That, of course, is the intent as of 1949. Again, the tragic legacy of not only major political figures like the Kennedys, Martin Luther King, and others, but in all probability a lot of more lesser-known political activists and media figures. Well, that is the basic testimony to the legacy of that kind of thinking. And again, as we examine the deaths of people like James Markham and Walter Karp, we have to ask the questions about whether their deaths were indeed suicidal or whether Mr. Karp's illness was natural or whether perhaps he received deliberately shoddy medical care in the hospital. Again, not a conclusion we can draw, but a questions we must ask and inquiries we must undertake under the circumstances. The last document that I'm going to read here from the book by Christy Macy and Susan Kaplan is a document from the 18th of October of 1967. It was declassified September 4th of 1975. Memorandum for the Chief of the Technical Services Division, subject N.K. Naomi, that was part of the Mind Control Research Funding Objectives and Accomplishments. And I'm just going to read you the objectives, not going to bother with the finance, skipping the first paragraph, objectives: to provide for a covert support base to meet clandestine operational requirements, B, to stockpile severely incapacitating and lethal materials for the specific use of the Technical Services Division, C, to maintain in operational readiness special and unique items for the dissemination of biological and chemical materials, D, to provide for the required surveillance, testing, upgrading, and evaluation of materials and items in order to assure absence of defects and complete predictability of results to be expected under operational conditions. 3. Accomplishments and goals. We have a relationship and a working agreement which provides a full range of information on technical developments, materials, and commodities suitable to meet our anticipated requirements. R&D activity has been reduced drastically and is currently held at an absolute basic support level. The program is oriented to maintenance of a state of operational readiness of selected materials and means for their delivery. The current program, as funded, provides a reservoir of research and development competency in the biological and related sciences in a special security environment suited to the needs of the clandestine services. Because of extremely limited Army funds available to it, Fort Detrick, Special Operations Division, cannot expand support to preserve a capability such as that currently maintained for the clandestine services if we curtail our support any further. Of course, once dispersed, such competence is not easily reassembled. 4. In 1967, six basic dry agents were stockpiled. These agents were assayed for viability and toxicity and replaced with fresh material when required. None of these materials are available from any other source and can only be produced in the controlled environment and facility existing in Fort Detrick. In addition, nine other materials and toxins are held in small amounts. The latter are unique and not available anywhere except the stockpile. Upgrading for improved stability and resistance to antibiotics is underway. 5. Quick response items, which do not adversely affect biological or chemical materials, and which can be incorporated into concealments, include minute fragile devices and special microbio-inoculators loaded with dry, lethal, and incapacitating materials. Repeating that last sentence. quick response items which do not adversely affect biological or chemical materials and which can be incorporated into concealments include minute, fragile devices and special micro-bio-inoculators loaded with dry, lethal, and incapacitating materials. These systems are tested periodically to assure reliability and are routinely surveilled to ascertain their effectiveness and suitability of loading and coating processes. Among the many delivery systems held in readiness at present are silent electrical launchers, mechanical launchers, rounds for loading into the launchers, ammunition concealment rounds which fit into carbines and rifles, and anti-crop dissemination kits. Various configurations are being upgraded as part of a product improvement program. 6. A non-discernible micro-bio-inoculator has been developed especially for use by the clandestine services and has been demonstrated successfully. The disseminating device is accurate at ranges of up to 250 feet and has a very low sound level. A small version of this is 0.015 inches in diameter, carrying a 0.5 milligram load and capable of being used in a noise-free disseminator, has been developed. Early tests have proven its feasibility and practicality for use at ranges of up to 50 feet. That last paragraph again. Numbers 5 and 6 in particular, I think, show us where by 1967, 18 years after the initial document that we read, where that basic research had gotten to. Minute fragile devices and special micro-bio-inoculators loaded with dry, lethal, and incapacitating materials that, as we read earlier, do not adversely affect biological or chemical materials. That was in number 5. And in number 6, a non-discernible micro-bio-inoculator has been developed especially for use by the clandestine services and has been demonstrated successfully. The disseminating device is accurate and ranges up to 250 feet and has a very low sound level. A very small version, 0.015 inches in diameter, carrying a 0.5 milligram load and capable of being used in a noise-free disseminator, has been developed. Early tests have proven its feasibility and practicality for use at ranges up to 50 feet. One wonders how many people have fallen victim to little toys like this, whether perhaps the James Markhams and the Walter Karps and the unnerving obituaries that we read so many of these days, whether perhaps they are the legacy of that research and whether they're the legacy of the Kennedy assassination and our other assassinations, which again are most significant to us because they reveal to us that by the early 60s the military had actively undertaken to eliminate those U.S. civilians which it felt to be inimical to its interests. So you thought you were free, huh? What do you think now? Well, good evening once again. Welcome back to the prepared portion of One Step Beyond. Something worth bearing in mind as you think about whether or not you're free. In the new book, October Surprise, by Barbara Honegger, as I've said before in the past, a very flawed book, but nonetheless a very valuable book, one that I certainly recommend. Barbara talks about the fact that the Reagan administration in January of 1983 hired some military and CIA psychological warfare experts to manipulate the press in such a way as to influence the opinions of the American people in such a way as to be beneficial to the Reagan administration. Again, in light of the open use of national security people to basically undertake a covert operation against the American people, as investigators have described that particular operation, it's worth reflecting on the deaths of people like Walter Karp and James Markham. For those people who eventually hear this program on tape, during the phone-in session of the broadcast last week, that being specifically August 6th of 1989, in a long discussion with a black caller from Oakland, I talked about, among other things, my belief that the large number of black officials who were being indicted for one alleged offense or another, or being pilloried in the news media without any indictments being filed, such as Mayor Marion Barry of Washington was done to him, that this represented, in my opinion, and obviously it's my opinion, a decapitation of black American political leadership. Literally, I think black American political leaders are being eliminated as part of what I feel is a long-term goal of politically neutralizing black Americans. And I think ultimately the national security establishment will do what is necessary to politically neutralize them if they will become more acquiescent than they have at times in the past. And I think something less than complete elimination is in order. However, it would not be out of the question, I think, for our national security establishment ultimately to put into effect something like the King Alfred plan, the contingency plan for interning blacks in concentration camps and then eliminating them, that we took a look at, first of all, in a miscellaneous archive show called The King Alfred Plan. And also, in particular, we compared the King Alfred Plan with the Rex 84 Martial Law Contingency Plan, as represented by the Sheehan Affidavit of the Christic Institute. We looked at that in Radio Free America number 32. And again, in this particular discussion with this caller, and he, by the way, agreed with me as a black attorney and educator, basically, again, I said that it was my considered opinion that black political leadership was being decapitated at the moment, and the following series of articles I think should be reflected on against that background. Very recently, the Bush administration's nomination of William Lucas to head the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice was turned down in considerable measure because of flack tossed in Lucas's direction by, among others, the Black Congressional Caucus. It's worth noting not only the fact that Lucas just received a Justice Department appointment anyway, but that apparently there is another battle looming with black congressional and political leadership over a Bush appointee. Information about that was surfaced in the Periscope section of Newsweek magazine's issue of August 14th of 1989. In the Periscope section, we find in the hot seat, or under the hot seat headline, Nominee War, Round 3. And just what a war this is, we're going to look at in a second, in my opinion. Nominee War, Round 3, from Newsweek's issue of August 14, 1989. President Bush may be in for another nasty fight if, as expected, he nominates Clarence Thomas to fill the Federal Appeals Court seat vacated last year by Robert Bork. Civil rights groups are concerned that, as head of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, Thomas hasn't pressed affirmative action laws. They also question his overall civil rights record. Poor old Clarence Thomas is the next victim on their hit list, predicts Republican Senator Alan Simpson of the Senate Judiciary Committee, which last week rejected the nomination of William Lucas to head the Civil Rights Division. Interesting wording here. Again, repeating that, poor old Clarence Thomas is the next victim on their hit list, predicts Republican Senator Alan Simpson of the Senate Judiciary Committee, which last week rejected the nomination of William Lucas to head the Civil Rights Division. But Thomas, 41, a respected lawyer, is considered a more difficult target than Lucas. A more difficult target than Lucas, and civil rights groups aren't sure they'll press the case. One Republican official warns that the opposition is, quote, opening a can of worms, unquote, if it fights the nomination. Well, whatever black political leadership in general and the black congressional caucus in particular decide to do with regard to the nomination of Mr. Thomas, Clarence Thomas, to fill the vacated seat formerly held by Bork, whatever they will be doing it without Representative Mickey Leland of Texas, who, as many of you are aware, has now been discovered dead in the crash of his airplane on a fact-finding mission in Ethiopia.